Welcome to the bike show with me, Jack Thurston. This is the first in a short summer season of editions of the show. I realise it's been a long time since the last episode, so I hope you stick around for the next few weeks because we've got some interesting things coming up. Now, here's a question for you. Who is Britain's most respected, most convincing and most effective cycle campaigner? Well, as far as I'm concerned, the answer is simple. Chris Boardman. And I say that because whenever I see Chris on TV or hear him on the radio, see him in the press, speaking at conferences or appearing in front of parliamentary committees, I relax. Because I know that there's nobody else who puts the case for cycling so clearly, calmly and convincingly. Chris came to cycle campaigning relatively late in his career, and his life journey has been an amazing one. From domestic time trial demon of the 1980s to Olympic gold medalist on that Lotus bike in Barcelona in 1992, he set an hour record of 56 kilometres that has never been beaten, and he broke Eddie Merckx's 1972 record for an hour on a traditional track bike. He raced professionally on the road and wore the yellow jersey in the Tour de France. After retiring from racing, he moved on to a career behind the scenes at British Cycling, and he helped British track cyclists rise to world domination. But he still had enough spare time to start a multi-million pound bike business, as well as working as a bike racing pundit on TV. Chris Boardman is one of my cycling heroes, and he's just published his autobiography entitled Triumphs and Turbulence. On this edition of The Bike Show, I'm delighted to be bringing you a recording of a live event hosted a couple of weeks ago by Rossiter's Books, in which Chris talked to Rob Penn about his life in cycling before an audience of hundreds of fans. It's a great listen, so without anything more from me, it's over to Chris and Rob.
I really enjoyed reading your book, really enjoyed it. Carpenter, champion cyclist, Olympic gold medalist, triple world champion, world air record holder, inspirational leader at British Cycling, coach, mentor, innovator, iconoclast, successful businessman, popular commentator, cycling campaigner, which means a lot to me, husband, father of six children. It is, by any measure, a pretty remarkable life for a dyslexic kid from the Wirral. So my question is, what do you think are your defining characteristics which have enabled you to go on this pretty remarkable journey?
I think more than anything else is just a fascination with making things, and that could be something out of a piece of wood, or an article in a magazine, or a cycling performance, or just a fascination with making things. And also finding a way through people that I bumped into, or one particular person that I bumped into, to deal with failure. Because dealing with failure is the most important thing, certainly for an athlete, but in any high-pressure situation, you're going to fail more times than you win. And you have to be able to cope with that, make sense of it, and to a large extent, use it. So it's just those two things, I think, underpin a fairly happy life. And I've been very lucky. I've got a wife that are obviously very supportive, but our lifestyle was set that I never had to be in a position where had to do something to pay the mortgage, even though I hated it. We have always kept our life small and manageable, and I mean Sally she'd just spend everything, but equally, I mean, because we had a very frugal past, when we didn't have any money, she could live on nothing as well. And that allowed me to go and take on, I wouldn't even call it work, just get involved in things because they were interesting and because they were something new.
As someone who reviews books and is very passionate about sport, I read lots and lots of books by great sportsmen, and they lack an authenticity which your book is distinguished by. And I also enjoyed the insight. There's some very funny bits, some great storytelling actually at the events themselves. And at times, just very simple honesty about yourself and your family. So it's a mix of these, as I mentioned, lovely potted biographies and home life and big sporting events. But why now? I mean, why? I mean, I know you've written other books, but why an autobiography now?
There's no master plan. Yeah. It was just a case of sometimes ask the right question at the right time.
Yeah.
And I can trace several key things that happened in my life to back to a mental coin toss. So we've got the first one, which was, you know, obsessed with scuba diving, same night as the club 10-mile time trial, which I had a little go at and quite liked that. And I had a few goes at that, and my parents, who didn't have much money, said, right, we've joined you in the scuba diving club, so which one are you going to do? And I went, the bike riding, you know. And that was it, was a huge one. And I've just got several of those things when something came along, and there was a choice. Bike company was a rambling email, badly punctuated, and it just looked like all the hallmarks of a nutter mail arrived from a guy who wanted to start a bike company. And I was going to delete it. And it was my wife, it was Sally, who said, "Ah, oh, go on, answer it." So I answered it, went to see him in Liverpool. And now, you know, we sell 70,000 bikes a year, and we're in 83 countries.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. But it was off at Shall I Delete It? And I've just come to accept sometimes things happen when they bump into you. Somebody said, "Will you write a book?" And for whatever reason, I said, "Oh, yeah, we can have a chat about that." And I ended up doing it. But I like doing new things.
But it seems that, you know, on those flip of a coin decisions, most of the time it's landed the way you called it. And I wonder if that... So you talk about love, you know...
Well, the bits that you've seen.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there is an alternative autobiography of everything that went wrong.
Well, but they, in the 90s was a messy time to be a bike rider.
Yeah.
And I was lucky that I had one little thing that I could do that had value and interested me, riding short time trials. And by the end of the 90s, even that wasn't possible anymore.
Yeah.
And I was obsessed, self-obsessed. And again, we were talking about it before, you're encouraged as an athlete to be selfish, put yourself first. And that spreads out into your whole life, really. It doesn't just stay with the sport and you get away with as much as you can. And we got to the end of the 90s and I was miserable and selfish. And Sally said, "Right, I've had enough now." In September 1998, and
that was her call.
Yeah, and I realised that mentally, she's gone. She's made that decision, and that was so good for me because it was a case of I had to go, what is important, and totally recalibrate. And that was a pivotal moment for me when everything changed. And we're still married nearly 30 years later. Yeah. We ignore each other, but we are still married. So, there's always moments then you don't plan them. They just happen. And then when there are opportunities, you take them or you don't.
Very good. Yeah. And just on terms, I wanted to know if you kept diaries. So some of, you know, there are certain parts of the book where the record's very good. You know, particularly the kind of training and some of the people you met and the circumstances of the labs that you went into. Did you keep a diary at all?
No, some of the colour sticks. I kept a diary while I was a pro bike rider. And it was very factual, to be honest, but there's some stuff in there that going back you can read into it. And I tend not to look backwards at all because you'll be embarrassed or you'll get frustrated. There's just no real value. So I only look backwards as it pertains to there's something to learn that I can apply to the next thing that we're going to do. So the one thing I regret, though, or one of the very few things that I regret, is stopping keeping a diary when I stopped being a pro bike rider. Because I've got an appalling memory.
Yeah.
I'm writing this thing down. I at first thought this is a nightmare because half of my life was pre-internet and you have to track people down to try and find out what actually happened and to add some information or to spark something off. But then I realised it's even worse when you have the internet because everybody can check your facts. So I actually prefer the first bit when it was in black and white, really.
The 4.5 minutes in Barcelona in 92, which won you an Olympic gold medal, you know, you put in a book that was the most important 4.5 minutes of your life to that point. And, you know, the first cycling gold, 72 years. It was also, we now know, a defining moment in the reawakening of this nation's appreciation of bike racing.
It was, and I think it's a little bit disingenuous because the event was important, but the person that was important in that event was actually Peter Keane. it actually, and it's not false modesty, it could have been anybody, very nice that it was me, but it could have been anybody who made us into a winning nation or reminded us that we could actually win things, not just make up the numbers. But Peter Keane, that was the event where he got credibility when 5 years later lottery funding came along and they went, brilliant, we've got lots of money for sport, first time ever. What do we do with it? And nobody knew because there was no professional body there. People were often in jobs by virtue of the fact they could take lots of time off work. And then one person said, well, actually, I've got a plan and I did it here and I think we can scale it up. And they went, great, and gave him the money. And he set up the world-class performance programme for cycling. And they got some success very quickly. He went and found Dave Brailsford. He employed Dave Brailsford, who took over and set up Team Sky and so on and so forth. So I think the lineage is there, but the lineage is back to Peter Keane, really, from that moment. And we also got Manchester Velodrome off the back of that, which was pivotal because you, I'm a great believer in success, breed success. And if you put a gold medalist into this environment and everybody's in the same place, everybody has got a golden yardstick for every training session, everything they do, and they can measure against this person who's already achieved what we're all aiming for and see how they're doing. And then when you get a few more, it becomes not quite self-perpetuating, but it's certainly everybody knows the standard every day of work. I forgot what the question was now.
Don't worry.
In fact, I don't think I even let you get to a question then, did I?
So you turned pro in 93, joined GAN, French team.
Was it in 93?
Yeah. And it was very interesting reading about your introduction to it. So you joined at the end of the season and you went to a training session and the only kit they could give you was one of Greg LeMond's spare skin suits.
Yeah.
It just sounded remarkably underwhelming.
Well, it was. Cycling through, since 2000, has become a mainstream sport and people have got their own camper vans and all it. But it wasn't like that. It was still very, historically, quite a small niche sport. And so that was a big opportunity because I'd had a small experience back here with Lotus, where they'd gone to a wind tunnel with these people who didn't know anything about cycling. And so they asked brilliant questions, and can you ride in this position, can you do this position? And I learned a lot of stuff, understood for the first time in a wind tunnel that aerodynamics is more important than anything else in cycling. And then I arrived a few years later in the pro world, and it was still, a bike looks like this because that's what bikes look like. So there was a big advantage to be had. And it was something of a cottage industry, really. Which was partly frustrating coming along and realising that it was pretty basic. It was frustrating and you didn't necessarily get to, you couldn't step in and just change it. You were the new guy and had to follow the way it's done. And we have these jelly sticks for food and bits of cake and that's how we do it.
And so you remained as a pro for 7 years, pretty much, six through to...
93. Six, the last thing I ever did was the hour record in 2000.
And, riding for GAN all through that, but you raced alongside all the kind of legends. You rode in several tours, several grand tours with Dauphiné. You rode, you could have pretty much did everything, didn't you?
I didn't do the cobbled classics because I was a coward, mostly. And... Yeah, I didn't fancy that. So I used to go to the Ardennes Classics instead. The Dauphiné was amazing. Yeah, that was a great little race. And I went into it a few times thinking, oh, I've done really well in the Dauphiné. The Tour's going to go great. And then I get my head kicked in the Tour. And it's like 20 years before you start to realise a lot of why that is. But it was a tough time to be a bike rider. And there isn't a lot of talk about drugs in this book at all, and I don't make any apologies for that. I think it's a topic that utterly needs to be addressed. It has been addressed for 20 years by very eloquent people, and it's one of those lessons that has to be learned. And cycling's in, I think it's in a pretty good place now, but I think for me it was important that it wasn't the only thing. There were some brilliant people in there and some great experiences. And I wanted to make sure that wasn't forgotten either.
Yeah.
And so Jens Voigt, of course, was was one of them, and I roomed with him for many years. And I would say he extended my career by 2 years because he was such an amazing character.
What's so playful and enthusiastic and entertaining? And
yeah, could segue nicely into reading a chapter of this book.
Oh yeah, good, come on, let's have a bit of reading, that'd be lovely.
That actually wasn't done on purpose, but it was a beautiful segue. Yeah, we were just talking about this beforehand, it's a bit off the cuff, but I thought I'd read you a little bit, if that's okay. It was a hot July day in the southeast German city of Karlsruhe. Jens Voigt and I were sitting in the back of a VW camper van, manhandling bottles of fizzy water. Shake, pause, quarter turn of the top. Just enough to let the gas out without spraying the contents all over ourselves. Repeat. Another 10 minutes of this and we'd have enough still water to see us through the 72 kilometres of the 1999 Breitling Grand Prix two-man time trial. The van belonged to our race support team, a crack outfit of enthusiastic local retirees assigned to us by the event organisers. Their main qualification for the job seemed to be their availability and their access to a vehicle capable of ferrying us to and from the airport with our bikes. Having stepped straight off the plane into the summer heat on the morning of the race, we'd asked if they'd had any supplies of water for us to fill our bidons. No, but they were happy to run off and get some, returning with four large bottles. They hadn't asked us whether we wanted still or sparkling. It hadn't occurred to us we'd need to specify. Team Sky, we weren't. We looked at the start list, all giants of the sport. Oh my God, said Jens. He started a lot of sentences that way. We're going to be dead last. He drew out the E in the word dead to emphasise his point. He did that a lot too. Looking at the sheet, I couldn't help agree with him. The majority of the invitees had been battering us all year. We were getting a healthy start fee for this event, but it looked unlikely we'd be receiving a share of the prize fund. I'd first met Jens at the end of 1997. He'd arrived for his first training camp with the team ready to ride. His bike was the only one of 20 with mudguards, the tips of which he proudly pointed out were the regulation 10 centimetres from the ground. I wasn't sure whose regulation he was referring to, but we all scoffed until it started raining. A massive tussle followed as riders scrambled to be directly behind him on the group ride, the only place that it was safe from being sprayed with muck. Jens's arrival on the team was a revelation. He was like a big puppy who saw everything as a game or adventure, whether it was a cup of coffee or an 8-hour bike ride in the rain. It was all to be savoured. His attitude to life was the perfect antidote to the sullen expressions of the management. I ended up rooming with him for his first season as a pro, which was pretty tiring. His batteries never ran down, and he didn't seem to have an off switch. Even when I was showering, he would insist on shouting a running commentary through the bathroom door on the cartoon he was watching on TV. His favourite was Cow and Chicken. His enthusiasm for life was infectious. It was impossible to be glum when Jens was laughing at things like how he'd hunger flat 100 kilometres from home. Ha! I was so bad, I was asking people to just shoot me. This was another favourite expression. On hearing that I had four children, he proclaimed that if he ever had that many, he would gladly shoot himself. In one early season race, we lined up at the start in temperatures hovering just above zero, and as we set off, it began to sleet. This is pretty much the maximum allowable misery in cycling. Any colder and it turns to snow, meaning the race is usually cancelled. Many in the peloton, including me, had already started to think about warm team cars and hot showers. Only one rider thought the conditions were perfect, a perfect excuse to attack or smash ourselves. Jens did smash himself, a gloriously futile solo break followed by a predictable collapse. Some hours later, one of the last men on the road and nearly half an hour down, he finally crossed the line where the team soigneur almost had to lasso him to get him to stop. On the way back from a small race in Normandy, the Dure Le Mans two-man time trial, we found ourselves stuck overnight in an Ibis hotel at Charles de Gaulle Airport. We'd been victorious that day, so we dumped our bags in the room and headed down to the bar, where Jens spotted that they had draft Grimbergen, a particularly noxious Belgian beer. He'd never tried it before and decided to spend the evening putting that right. I cautioned him against this course of action, to which he just laughed, smacked his chest and said, "I can handle it. I am a man." Later that night, I was thankful for his fastidious German nature, which compelled him to clean up every last trace of vomit before he left for his early flight in the morning. When we met up for our next race, I asked him how it was he'd managed to make it to the bathroom, which in an Ibis hotel is about the same size as a wheelie bin, but still failed to reach the toilet bowl. "Oh my God, man," he said, "I was already happy to have made it to the bathroom." With such a chaotic lifestyle, constantly on the road and chaining hotels every night, it's not surprising that pro riders like to room with the same person. You become like a married couple, but without the sex. When the UCI introduced its longitudinal medicals, regular blood tests, to create profiles for every rider in the peloton, it was natural that Jens and I went for our first test together. We'd been given the address of a clinic in Paris, where we were to stop on the way to our next race and have samples taken, simple enough. Having navigated our way through the narrow streets, we arrived at the specified location, a majestic and ornate six-story building. As we passed through the big oak doors, the noise of the busy streets was cut off and we were left in a silent foyer without a person in sight. We set off down an echoing corridor in search of help and eventually found someone who looked as though they might work there. In my pidgin French, I told them that we were there for the blood test and asked where we should go. They shyly mumbled directions and pointed down another passageway. When we finally found the waiting room, there were a dozen men already there. "Hi," said Jens, to no one in particular, as we entered. No response. Some minutes of gloomy silence later, we were ushered into an old-fashioned office where a stern doctor sat behind his desk. He directed us towards the two chairs in front of him and waited for us to speak. I reiterated that we were here for the blood tests. "Which one of you?" "Both of us." "You're both infected?" he asked. At this point, the sequence of events since we'd entered the building rotated slightly, clicked together, and formed a picture I didn't want to see. I decided I'd better spell it out. "We are here for the cycling blood tests, part of the longitudinal medical scheme. But this is a clinic for sexually transmitted diseases." We left the office swearing we would never speak of it again to anyone. It was Jens's never-say-die attitude that turned the tables for us halfway through that edition of the Breitling Grand Prix. On a long, straight stretch of road running back into the city, he caught sight of the favourites Laurent Jalabert and Abraham Alano up ahead in the far distance. That glimpse was all he needed. Like a homing missile, he went after them, with me in tow, trying to match his ferocious desire to hunt them down. When Jens was in one of those moods, it was visible in his body language. He rocked as he wrestled his machine, every muscle fibre pressed into service. Following behind, our support team pensioners also sensed the resurgence and gummed the engine of the campervan to bring them alongside, where they enthusiastically offered us the last of the now only slightly fizzy water. In the end, we won the event by 10 seconds and found ourselves laughing on the podium, both at the absurdity of the day and just how wrong we'd been in our pre-race pessimism. We each got a very nice Breitling watch for our efforts. I wear mine to this day and smile every time I look at it. Jens rode professionally until he was 42, attacking for the sheer enjoyment of it right until the end, before being cheered into retirement as probably the most well-liked rider in the world. He lives happily just outside Berlin with his wife Stephanie, their six children, and a menagerie of pets. To my knowledge, he has not yet shot himself.
That's lovely. It's a great portrait of clearly a great man and a very good friend of yours. You know, he was.
Well, I see him very rarely these days. He's just started to work on the tour, but he was the perfect antidote for me, and a real life lesson because he just decided. If you like, attitude is a choice, and I've decided that whatever we're doing, it's going to be great. And so he goes to look for reasons why it's great, whatever it is, and he's quite an inspiring person to be around.
But at the same time, his attitude is a choice. You know, drugs were also a choice in that period, in the 90s. And I just wondered, I mean, you rode with Armstrong and raced with Pantani and Rees and all of them. You know, did it come across your path?
Well, first of all, I think what was amazing is you look back now and we have facts to see it through. What we saw was crazy performances, and that we just couldn't reconcile. But then you just had to get on with it because that's what it is. And I can remember riding up one climb. It was with Stuart O'Grady, actually. And we were in the Grand Prix Midi Libre, and it was a few weeks before the tour. And Jan Ulrich, we went past Jan Ulrich, puffing and overweight. And Stuart said, if he's going well in the tour, that's just going to scar me. A very Australian expression. And then that was the year, I think that must have been 98, Jan Ulrich won the tour. But at the time, it's a case of, well, what do you do? What do you do? Because I have nothing other than, that's ridiculous. And so you just had to get on with it, or not, as the case may be. I remember much earlier, though, Roger Leger was our team manager. And we were at one of the, I think it was Flesh Alone, and the Jewish team got 1, 2 and 3 in this race. And he got all the team into the camper van and said, right, he said, this is all wrong. I can't remember exactly what words he said. This is all wrong. He said, and it's all going to hit the fan. And when it does, I don't want any of you near it. And he said, it might take weeks. It might even take months. But when it does, I don't want any of you near it. That was a really brave thing of a team manager to do.
Yep.
Whose livelihood depends on getting sponsors, so effectively on winning races. But yeah, I think our team credentials and the fact that we just used to get a kick in every week, so it was quite clear. But it wasn't fun. But you don't choose when you're born, and you know, when you get your chance.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask one more question, then I'm going to throw it out. So, you know, you wrote about the 1994 tour, which came to Britain famously. And again, it was another quite important moment in relationship to Brits and bike racing. And you were desperately trying to wear yellow when it got to the UK, and that didn't quite work out. It's a very good story in the book, but it didn't quite happen. But, you know, you were riding, Sean Yates was riding. 2 million people turned out on the roads of southeast England to watch it go by, and I was one of them. And I just wondered, you know, you wrote at the end of the story in the book that there was nothing for these people to go off and do. You know, there were no sky rides, there was no British cycling machine, there were no sportives, there was no Sustrans, there was no National Cycle Network, there was no infrastructure. And I wondered if, you know, you wrote there's just a queue of traffic and a lot of litter. And was that a kind of turning point?
No, I think it came later. I mean, I mentioned earlier about opportunities come along. And
a turning point for you personally, in that, you know, you've ended up as a cycling campaigner as much as...
No, it came much later for me. I mean, back then, I look back and you think, well, you had this opportunity, but there was no... What is it? Luck is capability meets opportunity, or capability on readiness, or whatever. But the tools weren't in place then. But there was enough impetus to see it come back in 2007. And by that time, there was things in place. So people went, oh, great day, and they turned around, and there was something for them to do, and the sportifs had just started to come along, which I think are a wonderful invention. There's over 800 now in the UK, and you don't have to have a licence, and you don't have to be in a club, and you don't even have to be a cyclist, and you can get drunk, agree to do it with your mates, turn up, and do it whatever speed you want. It can be a race, or you can do it in cut-off jeans and stop at every feed station and the cafe, or anything in between. And I think they're wonderfully non-scary ways for people to get from couch to club. So that and other things are now around. But it was 2007, really. And then there's not many links between sport and recreation and using bikes for transport. Excuse me. But I would say that the visibility from the sporting end from 2007, then 2008, we obviously got more medals from a cycling team than most countries. We were top 10 as a country in the overall medal table. You know, it was unprecedented. And then we had Team Sky, something to follow. We obviously had London. We had success in London with the Games. We had just constant 4 or 5 years of visibility of cycling in mainstream press. It became topical. And I'm convinced that had quite a big impact. But that's it was that time when I got asked to go and go on Newsnight, I think it was, during the games.
Yep.
And, and a section of that was on people riding bikes and wouldn't it be a good way to get around. And that's when I really got involved. Great. I'd been involved 10 years earlier on the National Cycling Strategy Board, which is about as interesting as it sounds. But what I didn't realise for 2 years was setting up a board was the action. It was a way of, there's that horrible phrase, to kick it, the topic into the long grass.
Right.
Oh yes, we're going to set up a committee to look into cycling. And then everyone goes, oh, okay, there's a committee. And then it calms down. But the committee just looks at it and nothing happens. So it was, I think it was just right, the right time actually for that topic. People wanted to do it, and everyone's really, well, there's no space to do it safely. And it probably takes about 60 days a year now, I think. And it's probably the most worthwhile thing that I'm involved in.
Great.
It sounds a bit melodramatic, but I think it's a good use of life to try and change how we get around or help influence how we get around in the UK, because I just like my kids to be able to ride the 450 metres to the park
safely,
or to be able to ride to school. And I think if asked that way, what parent wouldn't want that for their kids?
Yeah.
You know? And I think if you've then said, well, if you have to give up a little bit, I'd give up a bit, and I think other people would if asked.
Yeah, great. Very good.
It's a big soapbox. Are you willing to get me
started? No. There's power to you. Andy is coming down with a microphone. So would anyone like to ask a question? Gentleman over there. Is anyone over this side first? You're being very hesitant.
Just raise your hand.
Side?
I'll
no.
pass you a mic.
Can we get it?
Oh, well, I'll go for this lady here. I think she's closest to me.
And there we go. Very good. Lady up there.
Maybe point two or three out.
Yeah, great.
We can line them up.
Yeah.
Can I ask what you think about the state of women cycling in Britain and internationally?
That's a very topical. That's a good question. I'm just writing a piece for the Tour de France that will go on the second rest day about the fall and rise of women cycling. I have this discussion with my wife quite a lot, and we sponsor the Sarah Story's Podium Ambition team, so I've got a little bit involved. But it's how do you square this circle? Because it's not right that you have it's just an afterthought all the time, and how do you change it? And it's actually, because I guess due to Lizzie Armstead's win as well, it's very visible now. And there's organisers just in the last few weeks saying, right, okay, we're the first time we're having equal prize money, which is brilliant. It's a great statement, but it isn't the prize money that pays your salary. You know, that's the first step. But we might be about to get some momentum, I think. The circle is that you need to have media coverage to get sponsors, to have teams, for it to be visible, that people start to want to do it, and they don't want to televise it until it's a good event, so you need the people there to have it. So it's a circle, and the question really is, where do you break into it? Who should be the first person to say, well, okay, well, it's not healthy at the moment, so I'm going to start investing. So there's a few individuals that are starting to, but I'm going to do a piece on that in a couple of weeks' time on the tour, and we're speaking to Brian Cookson, Pro Tour team sponsors, to say, why haven't you got a Pro Tour women's team? Not loaded questions, just interested, why not? To an event sponsor and an event organiser and some riders, just to get a rounded view on, you know, what should happen.
Pan-European or exclusively in Britain?
Pan-European,
correct. Okay. Yeah, that'd be very interesting to read that. Gentlemen up there.
Firstly, thank you very much for everything you've done for cycling in this country and everything you're trying to achieve for cycling in this country. I'm sure I'm not alone in appreciating that from the audience. Last year, you produced a video having visited Utrecht, and then you encouraged ministers and people in power to go and visit there before making any decisions. How is that coming along, and how do you foresee changes and things happening in the future?
I've been heavily involved since 2012. I was really lucky last year or the year before, the Utrecht video? God, I can't remember now. Was it last year? I think it might have been the year before.
Reproduced on YouTube last year.
Yeah, so I was very lucky. Tour started in Utrecht, and I was given the opportunity in a programme about a bike race to do 5 minutes. And there's no substitute. You can have mountains of evidence, but stand in the middle of it and show people a picture of a way of life and go, isn't this great? and why don't we do this, is so powerful. And we got we invited members of the Treasury, Robert Goodwill, who's the Transport Minister, but he is a junior minister, Patrick McLaughlin, who's the Transport Secretary, who's really, to come over to Copenhagen. Let's go to Copenhagen and just ride around on a bike and let's have a look at what's done and whether we'd like to replicate it. The Treasury didn't even respond to say that he couldn't do it. Patrick McLaughlin said no. Robert Goodwill, who was a nice enough guy actually, fair play to him, he came and we rode around and we sat in a traffic jam of bikes and he had the opportunity to just say, imagine if all these people were in cars, Robert. And he totally could see it, and the best experience, the thing I enjoyed watching the most, and it happened to me on a previous trip, was going straight ahead and with a set of lights and there's cars alongside us. And we started off and Robert, the minister, stops and he's waiting for the car because the car's turning right across him. And the car's waiting and he's waiting. And the car wouldn't go because it's his right of way. And that's such a powerful experience. And they don't have to do the convoluted things we do with junctions because of that one rule that they put in place that everybody has a duty of care for more vulnerable road users. But having said that, it doesn't matter what Robert Goodwill thinks because he can see it and he goes to his boss and he goes to Treasury and said, here's the plan, here's mountains of evidence. And it's frightening, but the reality is it's individuals, what they think. It's not to do with evidence, anything else. It's just to do with individuals. So you've got it's a guy, I think it's his name is Greg Hands, the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, and Patrick McLaughlin, the Transport Secretary, who must ostensibly be saying, no, I don't want to do that, and that's it. Because there's no logical argument to not making cycling a real choice for people for short journeys. You know, 300 miles from our capital, 51% of kids ride to school every day. You know, it's unbelievable. We've got 25,000 deaths a year from pollution, directly related to pollution, 37,000 from obesity. Just under £1 billion a week is the cost of inactivity. It's ludicrous, but it comes down to personal opinion. So how are we doing? Well, something happened last year. I'm going to do this topic and then we'll move on, because I'll be on it all night. last year, we had something that happened which wasn't very newsworthy because it was really quite geeky and boring. But we had the cycling and walking investment strategy was put into the statute books, which basically says you have to have one. Legally, you have to have one. So it doesn't matter what it is, but you have to have one. And that was a big deal for us because you had a line. There was nothing in this space, but you have a line in the national budget for cycling and walking, and you must have a plan to promote it. So that happened this year. They produced a cycling and walking investment strategy, and it was launched on Easter Sunday morning, which might tell you something. And it was given £300 million over 5 years.
Yes, ma'am.
That was to fund it. Yeah. It cost double that to refurbish Bank Tube Station in London. So that sort of tells you how serious it is. So it's not in a good place at the moment, but all you can do is keep pushing and keep pressuring. And once you know what the rules are, it's a popularity contest,
yep.
Unfortunately.
Yep.
People vote for who they like and who they don't like, not on policies, because most people don't read policies. So it's a war that will be fought in the press. So my value, if I have one, to British Cycling is I can be really rude and they can disown me at any point. And it makes it a little bit topical, I suppose, and come up with silly comments like Bank Tube Station to try and make it newsworthy and embarrass the people in power,
yeah,
to have to comment, to have to make a statement. Because right now when they make a public statement, you can see Robert Goodwill, who always gets pushed out as the guy who's got to do it. He's almost staring at his shoes while he's talking because he knows it's ridiculous. I think it's about 76 pence a head as opposed to the absolute minimum £10 a head by the end of this funding cycle.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So anyway, there you go. We keep pushing.
Good.
And we will see.
Yeah.
Ultimately, though, just one final point on that. Ultimately, though, it will work. not through any kind of benevolence or forward, because it has to.
It has to, yeah.
It absolutely has to. In London, there's 10,000 people a month coming into London and not leaving. So TfL have done all that amazing stuff that they're doing, not through any kind of goodwill or cleverness, because they know that this city will not function in a decade if we don't change how people get around. And you've got to assume it's the same for the rest of the country. So it'll happen, it'll just take way longer than it should.
Yeah.
All right, I'm done now, sorry. Got that off my chest.
Another question, who would like to go? The lady down here, the gentleman up there.
The design of the road-going bicycle as we know it today has hardly changed since Starley introduced the safety cycle in the 1880s. We have, of course, seen the introduction of different materials and technology, as perhaps exemplified by the Lotus Sport, which you rode in 1992. As a designer and manufacturer, what do you see as the radical changes that will be introduced to the cycles we ride over the next few decades?
Well, radical, I'm not sure the word radical is going to enter into it. I mean, materials you mentioned. Bikes have stayed the same, I think, for two fundamental reasons. One is it's just incredibly efficient design, and it's really hard to, you know, or literally reinvent the wheel. It is just such an efficient way of getting around. It's hard, without it becoming a different vehicle, of course, to make it a lot better. Material choices, I think, are enormous. 3D printing's really interesting because you can make shapes that you can't make in any other way, and you can make internal structures that you couldn't make in any other way. So that's quite interesting at the moment, but still very expensive. I think electronics is probably the most interesting one. And integration is definitely going to happen, not least because it's aesthetically very pleasing. If you integrate your handlebars and your stems and all your brakes and you integrate them into a bike, it just looks like a really nice thing to look at. And that's a big driver of why we use this machine. So I'm not sure we're going to see much in the way of performance changes. I think we'll see design changes more for aesthetic reasons. And you see the bike reviews at the moment, and I'm so sick of looking at the same bike reviews of the same four or five brands. And it's, here's Peter Sagan's bike, and here's it. And all the changing is the colours, because we have hit a moment when we're stalling a little bit. If the rules stay the same, it's hard to know what you can do differently. Carbon fibre came along, took people a while to cotton onto that, but that allowed you to do lots of things. But right now, I think we're constrained by rules. I think the weight rule's going to go soon, 6.8 minimum weight, and they'll move to just a safety standard, which every bike manufacturer has to do anyway for their own security, their own insurances. So I think a lot of it will come down to the UCI.
Great. Lady down here.
Hi. You've achieved an awful lot in your life so far, and you've covered many different careers, and you've clearly got an awful lot more to give. What, at the end of the day, would you like to be remembered for? What would you like your legacy to be?
If I could be... Oh, it sounds a bit self-centred. If I could be instrumental, if I could help, say, right, 10% of people riding bikes by 2025, I had a hand in that happening, that would be satisfying. That would be the most satisfying. And as I said earlier, as poncy as it sounds, it would be a bloody good use of life to get that to happen. And you would leave. Because the bicycle, to me, bicycle racing, I enjoy watching it, and I can quite happily walk away, and I'll go and ride on tracks and paths, and I'll listen to my audio book. And if people didn't ride bike races, but they just rode to the shops and rode to work, that would be the best use of the bicycle for me. That's the most important bit, use of it for me, where it's being underutilised. So if I could help change that, I'd be delighted.
Right for that. The mic's gone back up. We're making Andy go up. It's like Andy's climbing Von 2 here. There's a gentleman up there, and then down here.
He's getting a bit of exercise in, isn't he?
Chris, if you were picking from history a team to win the Tour de France, to win the yellow jersey, Domestiques, win as many stages as you can. What I'm basically saying is, who are your from history top cyclists? Yellow jersey, green jersey.
Oh, top cyclists. Yeah, it's a really hard one off the cuff, to be honest. But I think, I'd go two. I'll give you. I mean, one would be Jens, just because he's what an entertaining guy to watch for many years, regardless of whether he used to win. He was He was what you would want sports people to be. And at the moment, on the road, I think Peter Sagan's absolutely fascinating. What a showman, what a really courageous, doesn't follow the script and do the logical thing. I mean, I don't know if anybody watched Tour of Switzerland yesterday. I watched the last few Ks. You know, the guy's a sprinter, jumps across, jumps away on a climb, pouring wet, rainy descent, catches up the breakaway. Everybody sits on him because he knows he can sprint, and then he still wins the sprint, and the bunch comes in 2 seconds later. You know, fantastic piece of showmanship. Watching him win the World Championships in Richmond, you know, in a similar kind of style, real panache is a word I would relate to him. And we need characters like that in cycling, really, that keep it interesting. They don't just win. They're not the Lewis Hamiltons of, I want to thank my mum and my dad and the dog. And you know, they've got, you see some authenticity, you see a piece of them. And I like watching. I appreciate people who ride and talk authentically.
Gentleman up there, and then coming down here. Yep.
What's the oddest marginal gain you pursued yourself in your own training, and did it work?
Oh, the oddest marginal gain we did. Oh, wow. Well, over 10 years, we conducted just under 20,000 tests and experiments. I actually totted it up because that's the kind of geeky thing that I do. 20,000 tests and experiments, and we tested mountain bike tyres, inflate and deflate on the move, so you could climb on hard tyres, let the pressure out, and we could have made that work, but it would have taken our entire budget to, excuse me, probably move somebody from 10th to 6th kind of thing, so we couldn't do it. A lot of the fun stuff actually was we didn't get it through. We knew that we could improve people's aerodynamics by running a rusty nail down their leg to make a ridge, but apparently we weren't allowed to do that, so we couldn't do it. I mean, there is a piece in the book actually where there was a genuine discussion that I'll step slightly sideways. The R&D team, over half of them weren't cyclists, and without fail, they were the ones who sparked off the real innovation, because they didn't know what you weren't supposed to do, and they asked the best questions. We sat in the bar one night. So the athletes used to come down and help us with some tests at the wind tunnel in Southampton. And they'd come in the evening before, and we were sat in the bar and having a chat. And I think it was Ed Clancy that was there, so probably one of the best first man in a team pursuit ever for Great Britain. Fantastic starter, but really wide shoulders. And Dimitris Katsanis, the engineer, said in Greek, "No, well, if we break his collarbones, that will make him faster." And then we started to talk about it. So you break your collarbone and let it set rounded. And it went on for about 5 minutes. And I was starting to get quite uncomfortable and had to sort of bring it to an end. Because Ed was looking quite enthusiastic for the whole thing. So Dimitris was just off for a hammer, and I just had to say, well, we'll leave it there. But it's hard to pinpoint one. There were so many weird and wacky things that we did. We looked at riding side saddle. There's definite, I mean, there's an aerodynamic advantage. I can't say too much because a lot of it's current as well. So it's not my show anymore. But there's a value to asymmetry. You know, there's potentially a value to asymmetry. So because instead of having two streams of air coming round and colliding and making a big lump of drag, you had them slightly offset. So they miss each other and you get a smaller drag. But we didn't have instruments centred enough to really pursue that. So there's tons of stuff that we looked at. And when you get together with people who aren't cyclists and don't know what you can't do, and you have, I mean, it was the most amazing experience that an adult will ever have, to say, here's a big budget, hundreds of thousands, you've got 4 years, go away and look at whatever you want, and at the end of 4 years, you don't have to have any viable, commercially viable product. You just have to make people go faster. Off you go. I mean, how wonderful is that? So we saw mathematicians, the military, Formula One, obviously, and all sorts of weird places looking for new ideas. And it was great. And I think we maxed out, really, because the rest of the world, it took them 8 years to cotton on to the fact that 90% of your energy is pushing air out the way. Aerodynamics is everything. And it took them 8 years, 2 Olympic cycles, to start to get to grips with that. So a lot of people have caught up now. There's still more. I think the British team's going to have a fantastic technical package it's not my show now. A guy called Tony Pennell's running it. I used to own the Jaguar F1 team, sold it to Red Bull. So a really smart guy. And I believe the package they've got is really good.
For real?
I think it's reasonable to assume that the Australians are going to introduce a package, and so are the Germans. Yep. So you may find it's status quo, a bit of an arms race. But I think it brings another exciting element to the sport, really, doesn't it? Where you don't know what's going to happen, and I think it's going to be good fun come the Olympics.
Mm. What are your thoughts on our chances in the Olympics, particularly with regard to what's happened at British Cycling and Shane Sutton?
Yeah, I'll take that in two chunks. Their prospects, I would say, and very crudely speaking, I would say if they get 3 golds, great. If they get 4, they've done really well. Yep. But they're in the hunt in a lot of events. And the World Championships earlier this year were your last audit, really, of where everybody's at. So it's not the Olympics. The Olympics is odd. It's in the summer, because normal track races, World Championships, are in the winter. So it's a bit weird. And it's very, very close. There's no nailed-on medals anymore. Yep. It looked for the last 3 years it was going to be the women's team pursuit. Suddenly, it's not. So there isn't anything nailed on. But they're close in so many events, you've got to assume the law of averages will say 2 to 3 golds. The Olympic road race course is interesting because it's very hilly. So, and people coming out the Tour de France, a la Chris Froome, could very well find themselves doing well in that too. So 3 to 4. Shane Sutton, I don't think it will affect the performance because it's, and I've said this quite a lot recently, it's like walking away from the wheel in a super tanker, really. It doesn't. If it's going to change course at all, it doesn't veer left or right. It just slowly moves. It's got mass momentum. Mm. You've got really experienced athletes. You've got really experienced coaches. You've got staff in there who've done 3-4 Olympic Games, and they won't let it fail. It's not in their interest to let it fail. They know their job. They know how to deal with pressure. So I think in that sense, it'll be good. I didn't enjoy seeing, regardless, I mean, and I think it's no secret, Shane and I didn't get on, but when we used to work together, but I didn't enjoy seeing a trial by press, and I thought it was ironic that somebody who was being accused of bullying was being bullied.
Yeah.
And everybody, forget the inquiry, he's guilty, sack him, it was pretty horrible to watch. That's not how it should be done.
No.
So inquiries don't come about. You don't get somebody to come in and audit your business when things are going really well. It's great, come in and pick it apart. I think it could be really healthy, a real opportunity, because I would say it's almost stagnated. It's been a victim of its own success in the last 4 years. Well, not a victim, but certainly been influenced by it.
Yep.
Where you've had this thing that worked really well and you'd love to keep it, but then Dave's gone and a lot of the people that were involved, some great sports scientists, coaches, have gone off to do other things or left or whatever. And there's a couple of people that are still there that were part of that. So everybody's just said, well, you were there, you run it, and cross the fingers. And it's not, it needs to be something different.
Yeah.
And that's why it was good in the first place, because it didn't do it the same way as everybody else. Mm. It looked, the phrase I used earlier, it looked at the demands of the event rather than the history of the event, and the first people to properly do that. So it needs to be something different, and there's a real opportunity. One person that sprung to mind, who I mentioned, was Sarah Symington, and she's netball, performance director at netball at the moment. She was archery, but she's a performer. She has that cycling background, but a really strong individual. There's an opportunity.
Yep.
Let's have a different gender at the top.
Yep. Yep.
Or also another route, which I'd be very interested in, is every business I've been involved with. I'll take Matt Davis, who was the head of Halfords, who I sold my company to. Fantastic bloke. He came from, he set up Pets at Home, made that a big business, so pet shops. Then he went to Halfords, which is car parts and bikes, and now he's running Tesco's, which is food. In other walks of life, you have professional leaders, and they go and employ the people who know about the thing and enable them to do their thing. Why couldn't we do that in the sport? Why couldn't we get somebody in who's a passionate leader who enables other people? We don't have to have an ex anything, and that would be an interesting approach.
Very good.
So I'll be fascinated to see what this inquiry brings and see what the shape is next.
Maybe one or two more questions. Gentleman here and then gentleman there.
Do you think the Tour de France can exist in its existing format of 3 weeks and
stupendous 200k at least distances. We had a very exciting week last week with the Dauphiné, with its shorter time span and shorter distance, daily distances. Do you think that's the way ahead, and that the future of the Tour is
shorter? In short, no. I think, you know, it's done 100 years, and there's a lot. It's like a brand, and you mess with the brand at your peril. You know, if it's successful, you know, you have a good reason to change it. I think if they halved the length of the tour stage or did something like that, we'd all still keep watching it, and it would still be great. But I don't think anybody's got enough of a reason to go and change it. It would certainly make our jobs easier if stages didn't last for 6 and 7 hours. But I don't think they will change it. I think there's probably scope to change a lot, like the Dauphiné, to change a lot of other races on the calendar to try and make them a bit more dynamic and slightly more punchy. But the problem at the moment is the volume of races on the calendar. Because you've got so many existing races and new ones trying to come in, there's nowhere to put them. And I think that's the biggest problem, is just the sheer volume of races. But I don't think they will, no, in my opinion.
Great.
I think we'll lose prologues, though. Mm. Actually, I've got something slightly to add to that. What I have enjoyed in the last few years is the tour organisers have started to have... He's hovering there, so I think we're finished. They've started to throw in a little climb with maybe 10 kilometres to go. Not big enough to see everybody out, but it's not a nailed-on sprint finisher. The sprint teams don't ride all day, and they've obviously put in cobbles in and crosswind in the first week. That kind of thing makes much more interesting and exciting. I mean, I'd have hated to be a bike rider in the current day with the way the format's for the tour. But they keep putting those obstacles and things in the final that make it really exciting viewing. And I think that change has really worked. And even though it was my thing, less time trials, because they are more predictable, which is why I used to enjoy them. But I think less time trials is a good thing as well.
Brilliant.
I did that question to death there, didn't I?
No, you did well. And actually, one thing I just add on that is the lovely story in the book about the tour which you did complete and the value that you took out of that as a rider. And it's just
a stage to Pamplona, out of the back after 5 kilometres with 7 mountains. Yeah, that was a fun day out. Yeah. Yeah. But that's what the tour's about, isn't it? It's the only event on a pro rider's calendar where you will finish. You'll go through all that just to say that you finished. It's the only one. Mm. And riding into Paris and seeing the Eiffel Tower, it is actually quite an emotional moment. You know, it's 3 weeks and everybody has big highs and lows, emotional roller coaster in a true sense. And it really special. It's something special to say that you've just got round it. You become a member of a club.
Fantastic. Great.
Thank you.
That was Chris Boardman in conversation with Rob Penn at the Blake Theatre in Monmouth. The event was hosted by Rossiter's Books as part of the Independent Bookshop's long-running series of cycling events. Chris Boardman's autobiography, Triumphs and Turbulence, is published by Ebury Press. That's it for the bike show for now. Until next time, goodbye.